Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Rick Dunning. The 100th anniversary of Holden, Finding the Ore, J.H. Holden, The Man and His Mine. Let's listen in.
Ready to get started. I want to welcome you all this evening. My name is Rick Dunning. I'm here for the summer as the curator of the museum. And this is the seventh summer that I've been working in that position. So finally starting to figure out some of the history of this place a bit. It takes a while. Got to hear the right number of stories to sort it all out. And I'm presenting this presentation on John Henry Holden and the 100 years since his discovery of the ore body and sort of an honoring of his centennial. So the session is titled John Henry Holden, The Man and His Mine. And what I'd like to do is share with you a little bit about who John Holden was, or actually his friends called him Harry Holden. So who was Harry Holden and how did he discover this ore body and what happened to him in the mine after he discovered the ore body? We could sort of divide Holden history into three even chunks. If we think about this 100 years that's passed since Holden discovered the ore body, about the first 30 years or so, the mine was under the control of Holden, and that's basically the 30 or so years we'll talk about tonight. The middle 30, 35 years or so, the mine was under the control of the Howe Sound Mining Company. In the last 35 years or so, the mine and the associated town have been Holden Village, the retreat center. John Holden was born in Massachusetts in 1855. Made his way west at age 19 and to seek his fortune as a miner. And he sort of experienced the typical miner story. He mined a while in Nevada and went broke. He mined a while in Colorado and went broke. Sort of always looking for another grub stake. A lot of odd jobs in between. Made his way gradually to the Pacific Northwest. And in 1888, he lived in Port Angeles and then Dungeness and prospected the Olympic Mountains for a while. Again, not much luck there. And after that phase, he became acquainted with a prominent Seattle family, the Denny family. Many of you from the Seattle area would know the name because they owned a lot of property. A big chunk of the University of Washington sits on what was Denny property at one time. He began to work for the Denny family. They had property and mines and commercial interests around the Northwest. He worked on their ranch for a while. He prospected for them for a while. In the summer of 1893, the Denny family decided they'd take a vacation up Lake Chelan. And they sent Holden out ahead of themselves to scout for campsites and do a little advanced prospecting, and they spent a couple weeks boating up and down the lake, camping and fishing and prospecting. Just your typical family vacation. That happened again next summer, 1894, although the financial panic of 1893 put a crimp in the Denny family fortunes for a while, and Holden continued to associate with the Denny family. And particularly became good friends with one of the Denny sons. His name was Victor Denny. And the two of them spent a lot of time together, prospected together, worked together in some of the Denny operations. 100 years ago, in the summer of 1896, Victor Denny and Harry Holden came up Lake Chelan again. And they were prospecting along the lake shore, particularly along the mouth of Meadow Creek and along the mouth of Railroad Creek, where they had looked in the past. And Victor Denny was called home to look after one of the family's other interests. one of the other mines that was paying off a little bigger at that time. And so John Holden Perry was here all by himself for the rest of the summer. He hired a packer by the name of Robinson to bring his gear up the Railroad Creek Valley, and he prospected up here the rest of the summer. Worked hard at it, beat the hills, and wasn't having much luck. Wasn't finding anything. According to the story, you've always got to take these mine stories with a grain of salt. But according to the story, one day, Holden was hunting up on the side of Copper Mountain. We can use a modern-day shot of Copper Mountain for that. Oh, it's a little out of focus, sorry to say. Up on the upper right side of that, the button doesn't work on here. I apologize for that. Good, right there.
Thank you.
Now, when we look at Copper Mountain from down closer to the footbridge, we, of course, see the old mill and the third-level tailings. But there's some other tailings piles up on the mountainside, and we'll come back to those a little bit later. Holden was hunting up here. We thought, on a previous occasion, he thought from Martin's Ridge he'd seen something over here of interest, but he looked around, couldn't find it. And according to the story, Holden shot an animal. There's a little confusion about what sort of animal. The typical story says he shot a deer. Others suggest a grouse. Whatever he shot supposedly landed on the ore body, landed right on the ledge of rock. And that's how we discovered where it stuck out on the mountainside. Now again, you've always got to take that with a grain of salt. I think the hunting part of it's probably true. Whether the dead animal landed there or not, I don't know. But that ledge of rock sticks out right about here. Right about that level on the mountainside. So he was up there pretty high. He knew fairly quickly that he'd come across something good that he hadn't seen before in this valley. He had a potential here. So he spent the rest of that summer digging out samples to send out to get assayed. So he mailed some of these samples off to Victor Denny and said, hey, have these checked out. But he also mailed some samples to somebody else that he didn't tell Victor about and also had those checked out on the sly. And it turned out that indeed it was a good ore-bearing body. He staked out his mine claims, the way you're supposed to do in order to establish your control of that territory. And then in September of that year, after his summer of digging around, he went down to file his mining claims. The odd part of the story is that when he filed the mining claims, the Denny family's name was left off. Forgot all about him. Forgot all about his grubstakers. They just filed them in his own name. And according to mining law, that makes them his claims. They're his. Now, Holden then spent the rest of that winter feeling pretty good about himself, came back the next summer and did some more digging around. Dug out some more samples. He hired a couple extra miners to come up with him. What he's interested in this point now is, what do you do with an ore body like this? Holden doesn't have the resources to develop a mine here the way that one needs to be developed. He doesn't have the technical know-how of particularly the milling end of the mine business. And more importantly, he doesn't have the money. And that's really what it comes down to when you're developing a mine of this sort. You've got to have capital. Got to have some funding to do all the upfront construction work that goes into getting the mine going. So Holden knew he was in this situation, and he concentrated his efforts on trying to find a buyer for the mine claim, trying to find some investment money at best, and perhaps a buyer.
Was Copper Mountain given a name after this event or before?
I don't know the naming of the mountains. When that happened, I would expect after, but I don't know for sure. Now, in 1898, Holden married a local rancher's daughter from Chelan. Her name was Alma Lord. And the two of them came up, and Holden by that time had built a log cabin up at Honeymoon Heights. And the newlyweds spent that summer mining, again, digging out more samples. What he was interested in at that point was getting some really good samples of ore to take out to potential investors, potential buyers. So he would instruct his miners to take the best samples they could and clean them up really good, and if they're going to take pictures of them, holding them out in the sunlight so you get a good sparkle off the rock, and so that the samples look their most impressive. In 1899, Holden formed... here's a shot of the Holden cabin, sorry. If we could focus that back down the other way, sorry. I don't know any way around this. Holden formed this company, the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. And he sold stock. He sold stock in this company as a way to raise money, a way to raise capital, to hire miners and to pay himself some income off of the mine. And so they used the samples and toured around the Northwest with these samples to try and promote the mine, try and promote the sale of the stock. And he was able to generate a fair amount of income off of the stock sales. He was a shrewd promoter. This is one of his promotion brochures, showing himself with presumably what is Lake Chelan in the background, and some kind of fancy hotel, though no one, such a hotel never existed on Lake Chelan, and no one knows exactly what that was about, but it's one of his efforts to promote the mine. Another here, health, pleasure, riches, the Switzerland of America, again, trying to generally promote interest in the mine, promote interest in the stock sales. The efforts paid off, his promotion efforts paid off in 1900 when he was able to lease the mining claim to a much larger company, the Drummers Development Company. What typically happened in the mining business is that a large mining company would first lease a claim. That way they could check it out, make sure it's okay. Once they know it's something they can work with, then they'll purchase it. But they'll do the lease first. And the Drummers Development Company worked as kind of a middleman type operation in this exchange of mining properties. And they had more capital available, more resources available. And so Drummers Development leased the claim with the hopes that they could develop it a little bit more, make it more attractive to a larger buyer. And so that was their approach. Drummers brought in some bigger mining crews. They built another couple buildings up at Honeymoon Heights, bunkhouses and shops to house the mining crews. And part of the Drummers' effort was to begin building a rail line from the mine down to Lake Chelan. And so they actually began constructing the roadbed in 1900, 1901, 1902, worked for several years at the construction of this roadbed. Part of the road we drive up on is this roadbed started by Drummers Development. Because that was one of the key issues, how are you going to get this ore out of the valley once you get it dug out of the ground. Here's a 1906 shot showing again the Drummers crew in front of one of the cabins up on Honeymoon Heights. To get a size of the operation at that point. They worked heavily on starting some new tunnels. Holden had begun one tunnel. Drummers began to develop a couple more tunnels in the ore body. And, as I say, building the railroad bed up to Lake Chelan. Their other effort was to build a smelter at Chelan, or at least try to build a smelter at Chelan Falls. That never got off the ground, but that was one of the other things they were interested in doing. Now, the drummer's lease, as I say, lasted a few years. In 1904, the drummers lost interest in the prospect. They decided they had invested enough money and it wasn't likely to pay off in the way that they thought. So drummers relinquished the lease. They gave the claim back to Holden, gave it back to his control. And that left him in the same situation again, trying to find a promoter, trying to find someone to buy the mine. In 1905, let me keep all my numbers here straight, the mine caught the interest of a big Chelan, or a big Spokane industrialist, J.P. Graves. And J.P. Graves was chairman of Granby Consolidated Mining, Smelting, and Power Company, based in Spokane. And he dabbled in lots of things, clearly. Mining, had a smelter operation that he'd begun, power companies, had his hands in lots of things. And again, he had lots of resources, lots of money. And that was the thing that Holden most needed, was capital for this venture. J.P. Graves bought 50,000 shares of the stock from the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. And at the annual meeting, the stockholders made him president of the company instead of Holden. Holden was still on the board of directors, but now J.P. Graves was its president. This is a fuzzy one to begin with, so we won't worry about focusing it. On the strength of J.P. Graves' involvement, Granby Consolidated then leased the Holden claims. And Granby came in with much more sophisticated machinery, both mining machinery and road building machinery, and they went at the development process with much bigger operation. So we can see some of the tunnel development up high on the copper side of Copper Mountain. Again, some more tunneling effort. And they did more work on the roadway. Smoothed it out better. They're still trying to develop it as a railroad bed at this point, but they continue to extend the work started by drummers. So there's several things that are valuable to Holden at this point. A, he's earning income off of the leases. So he and his family are making a pretty good living off of the mine without having to do much work on it. And these other development companies are putting in tunnels, they're building roads, they're building a town site for him. So he's getting the benefits of their efforts in the long run. This is an old shot of Honeymoon Heights about this time, the early 1900s. And again, you can see there are tents and several cabins and bunkhouses there. So Honeymoon Heights was still the center of focus for the mining community. That's the camp they used when they were up here working. Now, the initial Granby lease was 1907. They came up, as I say, with more sophisticated drilling equipment. They worked all winter. They didn't just limit themselves to the summer, so they were tunneling in the wintertime, extending those tunnels back into the ore body. They were digging ore out and stockpiling it. They weren't shipping it off to any smelter yet. They didn't have that transport possibility, but they're digging it out and getting it ready to ship. 1910, they extended their lease for another period. So they could continue their development work. About this time, the Denny family is more than a little perturbed at the situation, having been cheated out of, or feeling like they were cheated out of, what was their right to the claim. And seeing all this money pouring in from Granby Consolidated, the Denny family sued Holden, took him to court, said, we've got a right to part of this claim. Eventually, that lawsuit made its way all the way to the State Supreme Court of Washington. And as it turned out, the state Supreme Court upheld Holden's rights to the claim. They said whatever money you loaned him was that. It was a loan. It wasn't a contract for part interest in the mine. So Holden then had his mine free and clear. He had the benefit at this time of J.P. Graves and some of J.P. Graves' big shot lawyers in Spokane helping him in this case. So he was able to draw on those resources by himself. He might not have been able to put up such a good legal battle. But in fact, the state Supreme Court did uphold his ownership. We can look at this. Yeah, sorry about the focus again. We can look again at Copper Mountain just to sort of see where things are going on. The view from the village, Honeymoon Heights is right about here on the mountainside. So when you see this orange pile up on the mountainside, Honeymoon Heights, the camp area was right here toward the base of that. So that's where all those buildings were constructed. And there are several piles of tailings. We only see two of them here, representing tunnels into the mountain. And those were tunnels started first by drummers, but then extended more by Granby. Those were the areas they were working up. Up here where Holden's original tunnel is, and at these lower tunnels, that's the area they're working in. Now, as I say, Holden and his family are making a pretty good income at this point off of these leases. And Holden was able to purchase this home in Chelan. Nice brick mansion up on the hill in Chelan. Here's an interior shot of the home, nicely appointed. See some musical instruments in the background here on the left side. Holden was a big fan of music. He and his wife started the Etude Club in Chelan and gave concerts. Got friends together and formed a little band or orchestra and performed music, and even for some public events around Chelan at that time. Also became very active in the local Episcopal Church. Though he was raised Irish Catholic, in his efforts to sort of build his image as a important industrialist, mining figure, joined the Episcopal Church and became a key member of that. In those years, Holden became really a pillar of the Chelan community, one of its leading citizens, very visible in various functions around the city. Here's a kind of a fuzzy shot of Holden in those years. The sort of a Chelan citizen. But in 1914, J.P. Graves had to retire from Granby Consolidated because of health reasons. And because of that, Granby decided not to extend Holden's lease, at least initially. Then they picked it up, but then they didn't pay him anything for it. He was sort of pleading with them at that point. You can use your past month payments toward the purchase price, anything, just take the lease. And they did without paying him much money. So Holden was starting to get a little bit short of funds at this stage. And he was able then to borrow some money from a man in Chelan that had struck it big in the California lottery at that time. The man's name was Crooker Perry. And he'd won $20,000 on a trip to California in the lottery. So he came back and he was using that money to get himself started in the orchard business. But he also kept a lot of it in the bank and was known around Chelan as a pretty shrewd investor. And Holden convinced him to loan him $7,500. And as collateral, Holden put up the shares of stock, the controlling interest in the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company, and a number of other properties that Holden had purchased around town. Here's a shot of Crooker Perry. About this time, Holden was also having health problems. In 1916, Granby took one more look at the property, one more lease, and everything seemed very favorable. There were very favorable reports. They were enthused, and then suddenly decided not to buy it, not to go through with it. So again, the property reverted back to Holden. In 1918, Holden died of cancer after a fairly short bout of treatments. He succumbed to the disease late in 1918. But he hadn't paid off the debt to Crooker Perry. After an appropriate period of mourning, Crooker Perry went to court to try and get his money back. Took the widow Holden to court to try and force her to pay off the loans. The only way she was able to pay off those loans was to sell all the stock, all the controlling stock of the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. So in 1922, that stock went on the auction block. And the day it was put up for auction, who showed up to buy it but Crooker Perry? And he purchased then all of the controlling interest in the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. So, in all those years, from 1896 to 1918, Holden had worked so hard to promote this mine, to try and see it develop, to see his dream come through. And just on the verge of that happening, he died and his family lost control of the mine. So after 1922, the Holden family is out of the picture, and it's the Holden mine only in name from that point on. Of course, Crooker Perry was in the same position as Holden was at that point. He had this property, and he was even less a miner than Holden was. So he was left with the problem of trying to develop the property, trying to sell the claim to somebody else. For a while, Granby thought about it again. One more look from Granby. And again, they decided to pass on it. But there was an engineer working for Granby by the name of Brennan. And after they had opted not to take this property, Brennan switched companies and went to work for a Canadian mining company called the Britannia Beach Mining and Smelting Company. And they had a big mine up on the Howe Sound of British Columbia. And Brennan said, you know, I know about this property down in Washington. You know, and at that point, Britannia was starting to expand. They wanted to get another property to add to their holdings. They were looking at three, and Brennan was pushing hard for the Holden property. So Brennan and the Britannia Beach supervisor, C.P. Browning, came down and they took a good look at the Holden mine. And on the strength of their recommendations, Britannia Beach Mining and Smelting decided they would lease the claim from Crooker Perry. And then almost immediately decided they would buy the claim outright. So in 1928, Howe Sound purchased the claim from Crooker Perry. And they paid almost $250,000 for the claims. So Crooker Perry had altogether invested about $20,000, both in his loan to Holden and his purchase of the stock. So he went from an initial $20,000 investment to $250,000, which in 1928 was pretty good financial turnover. Though you can, I think, imagine some of the disappointment in the Holden family at this stage, seeing the property sold for that much. Howe Sound came in, Britannia Beach Mining and Smelting Company, after they purchased this, reincorporated as the Howe Sound Mining Company and moved their corporate headquarters to New York City. in fact, Britannia Beach Mining and Smelting and Howe Sound really, when you get down to it, were a group of New York financiers, capitalists again. They had the money to get the Britannia Beach Mine going, and they had the money again to develop the Holden Mine. So Howe Sound was, in terms of corporate structure, was this cluster of financial wizards in New York City controlling a couple mines out in the west here. So they came in 1928 with a group of engineers and geologists, and again, they used Honeymoon Heights. Here's what Honeymoon Heights looked like in the late 1920s. Lots of small buildings crowded together, a couple of longer bunkhouses. If you walk up to Honeymoon Heights, you can see the foundations of many of these buildings still. And you can still find a remnant of Harry Holden's cabin. See the roof still, the roof of his old log cabin is still sticking up above the ground. So you can find that up there as well. Another shot of that Honeymoon Heights camp. In 1928 to 1929, 1930, Howe Sound's engineers and geologists were mostly doing planning work. How are they going to develop this ore body? Early 30s, though, remember the Depression comes along. And that puts a damper on the metals market, financial picture in general. So in 1931, Howe Sound closes down their operation and hold it. And they're going to just sit on it till the financial picture improves. Finally, in 1936, they came back into the valley, finished their planning work. In 1937, the building process started. They brought in the heavy equipment. You can see we've gone to much more sophisticated road building equipment. So they're finishing the roads, building the switchbacks, bringing in the lumber to start constructing both the mill building, which we see the wreckage of, and the town here, the town site. So they expand their tunneling effort. And Howe Sound came in with a new tunnel, lower on the mountainside. And that allowed them to get farther back in the mountain and work down lower on the ore body. So their main tunnel is actually lower than any of the upper ones up on Honeymoon Heights. It is even with the top of the mill building that we call the third level today. Here's the mill building they constructed. So this would be essentially the third level, and we can see then the mill was here to process the ore. Because when the ore came out of the ground, it was too low a concentration to ship it down the lake as is. They had to take the ore and in a series of crushing operations, grind it up into a fine powder, and then chemically extract the valuable metals from the rock. Then all the waste rock got piped down the valley to make the tailings piles, the big orange piles we see today. Finally, in the spring of 1938, Howe Sound shipped their first concentrate down lake. And then they operated for the next 20 years. Howe Sound operated this mine pretty much continuously from 1938 to 1957. And that was the years of the primary activity of the Holden mine. But again, by this point, the Holden family's out of it. Crooker Perry's out of it. By this point, he has no more interest in the mine, and it's the Howe Sound Company that did the mining here in the Railroad Creek Valley. Another shot. Yeah, that's all right. That's kind of a quick overview of the early history of the Holden Mine. A lot of that information comes from a little book that's available in the bookstore, called The Holden Mine, Discovery to Production, which covers those years from Holden's discovery 100 years ago to when Howe Sound took over. It's a very inexpensive book. It was the doctoral dissertation of a man named Nigel Adams, who actually grew up in the Holden mining town, son of a miner, went on to get his PhD in history and taught history on the college level for a number of years. And So if you want a good, close look at this early Holden history, that's a nice resource to get hold of. Like I say, I wanted to give you an overview of Holden and his life and his involvement with this mine. I'm happy to try and answer questions that you might have about Holden. Maybe we could flip on a light over there. Thanks. That's good.
Is it possible that those upper tunnels, are those something you can go check out?
No.
You're fine?
No, those are
paths up there.
You can see where they were, but those entrances have collapsed like the main entrances. Yeah.
When you go up to Honeywood Heights, what's the first building you come to on the left there?
Just off the road? And well, you're still on the road, or?
There's a sign that says Honeywood Heights.
Oh, all right. That's just one of the homes that were up there. There were about 14 or so cabins up there. After Howe Sound was operating, of course, they built accommodations down here, and the married miners and their families built their homes out in Winston Camp, what we call the Miners Village today. So most people live not up at Honeymoon Heights, but down here once Howe Sound's operation got going. But there was a little group of young married couples who liked being isolated by themselves up there on the mountainside. So they continued to live at Honeymoon Heights for the first decade or so of the mine's operation. So the buildings you see there are mostly what's left of the homes.
It's just hard to imagine that many buildings being so overgrown.
Yeah, it is. I haven't found all of them.
I wouldn't.
Yeah. Like I say, there's about 14 or so. And you can find most remnants of most of them, but I haven't seen all of them yet.
And you can still find Holden's there?
Kind of in the...
How do you find that?
When you first come to the area, he mentioned where you see the sign and the first set of steps, and you just kind of head up the hill through the trees there. The trail is looping around at that point. Kind of in between where the trail loops around is what's left of the peak of the Holden cabin. Question over here.
What connection was the search for a railroad pass and that all prior to
that
this taking place?
Yes, that's a good point. Because the history here really does go back more than 100 years. The Great Northern Railway was looking at this valley as a possible route onto Seattle, and their survey team came through in 1887. And they did some surveys of the valley, made note of some of the mineral resources that seemed to be available. That report was kind of circulated. They continue to kind of poke around in the area. Even though they decided to route their rail line elsewhere, they sent a survey team back in the early 1890s to look again at this area, not so much to run their route through here, but to see if there was enough mine potential to justify a spur line up to Chelan. And actually on that very last rail survey, Holden tagged along himself. So he wasn't part of the survey crew, but he sort of went along with them on that last little look up Lake Chelan.
When was the tram built? There was apparently a tram up
there. That would have been in the early Howe Sound years, so in the 1930s.
What was the temperatures of the mine? Was it cool?
It was mainly pretty cool. So it was 60s.
What's the difference in that one mine in, was it Nevada or that silver mine that got so horribly hot?
Part of it's the depth.
The
same is true in South Dakota where the mine is going more than a mile below the surface. You get deeper and deeper, you start to encounter warmer temperatures, but fairly close to the surface. Remember, most of the mine is not far from the surface of the mountain, so it's not really all that far underground.
And that's just getting next to the, magma or some kind of...
It's just the Earth's internal gradient.
Right.
You've got heat in the Earth's interior, and the deeper you go, the warmer temperatures you encounter.
Does that seam run from where Holden was first tunneling up above and straight down, or is it on a slant? And does those different shafts connect inside? And is there still quite a bit of ore in there?
There is quite a bit of ore. And those high tunnels were used by House Sound and connect into their network. House Sound came in low on the ore body, and then they mined upward toward where it sticks out on the mountainside. And the layer of rock does kind of tilt into the mountainside. It's, the ore body is contained within a fairly discrete layer, about 80 feet thick. And that just...
You put up the screen and draw on the
whiteboard. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. This works. If this is the side of Copper Mountain, the ore body kind of tilts in something like this. So Holden found it sticking out up here, and some of those early tunnels come in at this level to get at it. Powell Sound came in at a lower level, and their main tunnel goes a half a mile into the mountain before it gets to the ore body. And then they went up from there, and they mined it at several different levels above their main tunnel to get all the ore above the main tunnel. By about 1945, they had most of that out, and then they started going down from there and mining over to the ore body that way.
And Rick, I remember something. Didn't that have something to do with the fact that as they went down, it was more expensive for them to mine, and then when the South American mines opened, they just said, psh,
that's yep. it. That all contributed to the closing of the mine in 57. That when they're working above the main tunnel, they essentially got gravity working for them. That's helping them to get the ore down and out there, out the tunnel to the mill building, which is over here. But when they're below the main tunnel, the deeper they go, the more expensive it is to raise that ore up out of there. By 1957, their equipment's starting to get old. When the price of copper drops suddenly in 1957, due in part to the opening of Chilean mines and other sources, in part to the end of government's price supports for copper, then they shut off the switches. That's when they shut off the operation in July 1st of 57.
Where were the other part of that seam deep when the land shifted? Did it down?
The layer of rock actually, it's harder to draw in a three-dimensional view, but actually runs across the valley so that the rock layer catches the front edge of Copper Mountain, actually runs across the front edge, and it's about a half a mile wide. It's about half a mile from top to bottom, the whole workings of the mine, and it's a half a mile wide from side to side, so it's a pretty extensive mass. But then that same layer continues into Buckskin Mountain and continues across the valley toward Holden Lake and Martin's Ridge. Now, they explored all those areas to see if the good ore continued, but it didn't. They did diamond drilling in the valley bottom and on Martin's Ridge. They dug a tunnel that goes all the way under Buckskin Mountain, trying to find an extension of the ore body, but it was only concentrated enough in this one area to mine.
Has there been further collapse of the mine area?
Not that
noticeable from the surface.
Not that we can tell. A lot of this layer of rock is gone, and the stopes, the big caverns in there, particularly in the upper part of the mine, are huge, big underground caverns. If there's going to collapse, that's where we'd see it, and we'd see it on the surface expression of Copper Mountain. It hasn't happened yet. It could, particularly if the area is given a good shake in an earthquake. But it's very hard rock in there, and one would expect most all those tunnels and stopes should be open. It does seem like the lower part of the mine is flooded, as best anybody can tell, because there's water continuously draining out the main tunnel. So you might expect that everything here up is full of water. The mine company did pump tailings back into the mountain to fill up some of those stopes. So there aren't as many tailings out there as there could be. But some are open, and they should be wide open up to this point. The only thing that's really collapsed are the entrances of the tunnels, because those went through loose glacial sediments and had to be timbered. And when the timbers rot, that allows the tunnel to collapse.
Do they reach the bottom of the seam?
No. By 1957, they were their diamond drilling showed it extended at least another 700 feet below where they were. And there was a ore at the bottom of the mine waiting to be brought up. They didn't even bother to take that when they shut down.
What's that hard rock type mining and that ore they got out of there versus what they get in South America or over Anaconda or Montana and those places? What's the difference? Or is it the same?
Part of it, I think, is what we're seeing more of in contemporary mining is open pit mines.
Right.
And they're going after actually lower grade ores yet.
This
content would have been about 2%. Some of the contemporary ores are maybe 0.3% copper. And so you gotta work with a huge volume of it to get any copper at all out of it. So they're mainly chemically leaching the stuff in large masses out of these open pit mines. And they use huge machinery, and that allows them to cost effectively get the copper out.
So if this was called a low grade, then what would have been considered like a high grade?
Copper does occur in a pure form. And it has been, particularly in some of the mines in northern Michigan, it was mined as pure copper, so it can be 100%. Wow. Never know quite what to say ultimately about Holden's history with this place. Sort of get the impression he walked a fine line between shrewd and sleazy in some of his operations. And I suppose in the grand scheme of things, most of the evidence comes out on the side of shrewd. He was careful, he protected his interests. He looked out for himself, certainly.
His health just gave out too soon.
Health gave out too soon.
How old was he?
Oh, born in 55 and died in 17.
Yeah. Whatever happened to the families, maybe they tried to find out what.
In fact, is one of his sons came up to visit before he passed away. He and Alma had four sons. John was the oldest. Eventually, he worked in Hollywood as a musician, playing for movies and composing for movies. Charles, the next, was an engineer. Lucian became a professional singer, and the youngest son, William, was a golf professional, played on the pro tour. All of the sons have passed away. The only member of the family I've met is one of the granddaughters, who's been up to visit within the last few years. And Alma passed away in 1964. She was 23 when they married, and Harry was 43 when they married, so she was considerably younger. But their stories of family life are pleasant ones. They had a close-knit family, particularly the musical interests that they did a lot of musical things together as a family.
Yeah, then the river from the tailings, or the creek out from the tailings down, is that a sterile creek then to this day, or does it come back at all?
Well, it's the first couple of miles below the tailings probably is pretty devoid of much ecosystem. There's the acidity of water draining out of the tailings is really the biggest problem. As water drains through it, it becomes acidified, being in contact with the sulfur that was part of the ore. That acid water is damaging to the stream ecosystem, but also it dissolves metals that are still in the tailings, zinc and copper, and those dissolved metals get into the ecosystem and tend to kill off the insect life as well. And without the insect life, there isn't much of a trout population through there.
I've heard they moved the bed of the creek in order to accommodate the tailings. Any idea of water might be going where it used to be?
That's one of the primary concerns. To fit all the tailings on the valley bottom, they had to take Railroad Creek and shove it over to this side and then build wooden cribbing to hold it in place. You can still see some remnants of that when you cross the footbridge. And then that gave them the whole valley bottom in this section to put the tailings, and that tailings cover 80 acres of land. And yes, there are old stream beds at the base of the tailings piles, and they may act as conduits to funnel the leachate, the water draining through the tailings. But it's a hard thing to get a handle on.
Rick, what are those wells that are part of this reclamation project? What are they actually measuring there? Water level or water?
Some are for water level, and some are actually available to sample the water in the tailings to see what's happening.
Who's officially doing that? Whose research is that? Forest Service?
Some Forest Service, some West Bureau of Mines, but as Bureau of Mines takes a big budget hit currently, Forest Service will probably take that over. The question now is, there was a reclamation effort to get the tailings covered with gravel, start some trees growing on them. That has been successful to the point of controlling dust and visually making them look a little better. But the remaining question is, what about this water draining through? And that's the current monitoring effort to see how bad it is and what, if anything, else should be done about it.
Did EPA laws have any effect on that?
Well, there apparently was some Superfund money involved in the reclamation work so far, and the current monitoring is to try and decide whether it should be ranked higher on the Superfund list, have a higher priority. And if so, then it gets more and more complicated as to what can happen to it. Other questions?
How many people worked in the mine here when it was peak?
Well, typical shift would run 100 to 200 miners underground, maybe 40 or 50 in the mill. And they ran three shifts a day.
They went 24 hours a day.
Yeah, 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. So it was a pretty good crew. Peak population was probably over 1,000 people in the valley.
So your copper's coming back up. Is there a possibility of reprocessing the tailings? Is there enough copper in there?
Probably they wouldn't bother for the copper. They might for the gold. Hmm. There's still a fair amount of gold left in there.
In the transport of the ore to Chelan, did the House Sound have their own barges?
Yes.
And how many would you guess they operated when they were at their peak?
I only know of one tugboat that ran the barges up and down the lake, and it took only one barge at a time.
How many canisters do you think it could hold?
I think its maximum load was 45.
That's quite a few.
Yeah, it's 5 tons per canister times 45, so it's hauling a fair amount of concentrated.
That's a lot of trucks up and down to get 45 up and down.
That's right, yeah.
How long before they could make that load?
I don't know the turnaround time on that. I'm going to have to find out some of the details at that end of the process. I don't know for sure.
From the concentrate, then what would, when they went to smelt it in Tacoma, how much further was it reduced?
Well, they
until you get your pure copper,
right?
Came
out of the ground about 2% copper. It went down as concentrate at about 25 to 30% copper, or 25-30% good stuff, and then to the smelter where it was purified completely.
And the smelter, would they take the gold and zinc and all that out of it?
No, all that was separated at the smelter. They experimented for a while with taking the gold out here, and that didn't work very well. So.
You may have mentioned this earlier, and I'm sorry I came in late, but what was the connection between House Sound and Salt Lake City?
Boy.
Because I thought House Sound was a Canadian company.
Well, their first mine was in Canada, and their initial operation was based in Canada, but it was really a group of New York financiers that put up all the money for that. And so after they got the Holden mine, they reincorporated as a U.S. company and based their operation in New York City. I don't know of any connection to Salt Lake.
I thought I read somewhere that there was a connection to Salt Lake when they were trying to sell it. But maybe I'm incorrect on that.
Not that I know of. They had another mine in Arizona and a couple more mines in Mexico by the time they finished here. So this was not, and the Britannia Beach mine in Canada continued a little bit longer than the Holden mine did. But there were some years when this was their main source of income. It was a big producer for them during those 20 years.
You know, Rick, just an aside, and I think this is accurate, that during, we think of Railroad Creek Valley as being a really quiet, peaceful place, but when the mine was in operation, somebody I talked to at one point, maybe a child of one of the miners, I can't remember, said that the ventilation fans that they ran, you know, to keep the air circulating in the mines made a horrible noise.
Yeah, it was tremendously noisy.
It was a huge roar all the time.
The sound of the mill, the crushing machines, and the trucks, it was a noisy place.
Yeah.
From the pictures, it looked like there used to be a lot less forest here, and now there's more. Is that continuing to trend?
There's some strong indication that up valley here, the forest burned at the turn of the century, and many think that was an intentional burning by some other prospectors who wanted the trees out of the way when they did their prospecting. So there was a major fire at the turn of the century that burned up valley from here.
The house on Company Mine logged extensively down the creek on the other side for timbers from the mine.
They did, and also in the early 60s, a Swiss logging crew came in and logged that side of the valley, too. So that was during the early years at the retreat center.
Was there a mill down on the lake, too?
No. Nope. The buckets of concentrate went down to the lake, loaded on a barge. From there, they went to Chelan. Then they were trucked from Chelan down to the Columbia River, where they got loaded on the train to Tacoma.
How about the sawmill?
The company did have a sawmill here, yes.
Has there ever been any study about the impact overall of the effluent from the railroad creek and the tailings on the Lake Chelan itself?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I know of.
Rick, when did the property where the village is, that was National Forest ground when they built? When did that
still is?
Right. When did that become National Forest ground?
I don't know when the.
Was that before all this mining?
Yeah.
I think the National Forest of 1897 is when they formed those someplace in that time.
Yeah, so around the turn of the century.
Public land before that time.
Yeah, it would have been public land prior to that, certainly.
Even after the formation of the National Forest, the mining claims.
Teddy Roosevelt would be more on the license. Yes, yeah. You know,
thank you. Well, I think we need to wrap up and have a little time to get to Vespers. Last question?
One comment on the toxicity,
sure.
And all that with Craig. Trout's a very good indicator of it. And I fish from at least 8 miles all the way up through the tailings to the ballpark, and have noticed no difference in the number of fish any place in the stream. So I don't see any impact. I haven't over the last 10, 12 years. That was before the reclamation project.
No,
after. So.
Yeah, some people suggest that the volume of Railroad Creek is so high that it essentially dilutes the leachate. That's part of what they're trying to determine.
Isn't it also true, though, that the trout can swim through
right.
the area without a problem, but they can't live there because there's no food.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.